No one has ever believed the story of resurrection. That's what I realized this week from the first people who hear it. The disciples gathered in that room of grief and guilt. The women come to tell them what has happened. The stone rolled away, the body gone, two men in dazzling white. Joanna and the two Marys sputter it out breathlessly, this life-changing, world-saving story. And it seemed to them an idle tale, which is a weird phrase, an idle tale. The word really just means nonsense, foolishness, or even delirium. It's craziness. It's stupidity to believe that kind of story. The root is to bark or to howl. The women are barking at the moon. They are crying wolf, or whatever the opposite of that is, insisting to an increasingly skeptical audience that something good is going to happen, though everything around them suggests otherwise. That's what it's like to preach Easter. Not that you asked, but to tell this story again today, I was saying to a seminary student this week that now feels like the hardest possible time to tell people about resurrection, to convince them of it, to convince you of it. Even if no one has ever believed this story, this moment feels particularly difficult. A generation or two ago, people were skeptical about the science, like, of course, about the idea of like a physical bodily resurrection, but they could at least buy into the metaphor, the idea that it could all eventually turn out for the best, that it will finally all turn out for the best. But now, I think most of us have a hard time even getting there. Things are rough, and we expect them to get rougher. Wars that break our hearts every day, a political system in freefall, a pandemic that has laid bare the fragility of our bodies and our society, and beneath it all, that deep dread of what is happening to our planet, the certainty of collapse. It's a tough time to preach resurrection, to suggest that it could all suddenly work out, that it will, that it has. We're not expecting a happy ending, which, to be fair, is how happy endings always work, when they work, unexpectedly. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, coined this word for this unpopular idea, the sudden joyous turn, the surprise happy ending. You catastrophe, he called it. Not you like Y-O-U, like you're a catastrophe, but you like euphoria, utopia. You meaning good. A catastrophe being that sudden turn, a sudden turn for the good. He believed in it, in his stories and in real life. He said that you catastrophe gives us a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality or truth, the good news that is still there beneath all the bad news. And he called the resurrection the greatest and most complete you catastrophe, the happy ending to outdo all happy endings, entirely unexpected and entirely true. But no one has ever believed the story of the resurrection. When Tolkien wrote about eucatastrophes, he was in an argument with people who said he should write different kinds of stories than the ones that he wrote, full of dragons and elves, fantasy stories. They were escapism, his critics said, and he would do better to write more realistic stories, ones that captured, quote, the rawness and ugliness of modern European life. It was 1938. Things were rough and about to get much, much rougher. Tolkien, his critics thought, should be writing about the gritty, devastating reality, not spinning fairy tales that deny the hard truth. But he refused to concede that what he saw around him was more true than what he created. The maddest castle in a wild Gaelic story, he said, is not only much less ugly than a robot factory, it is also a great deal more real. His stories touched that deeper truth that lay beneath that moment and every moment, the solid foundation on which all our stories rest. A solidity that reveals the flimsiness of everything that seems solid in this moment. Which is more enduring, Tolkien asked, the chimney or the tree? Which one will be left standing at the end? You catastrophe, he said, doesn't deny the existence of sorrow and failure. It denies, even in the face of much evidence, universal final defeat. Universal final defeat. I think that's what a lot of us have come to expect, or at least to fear, what scientists call an existential risk, a catastrophe that causes the end of human life, or at least cuts off the possibility of human thriving for many, many generations. Some of their favorite likely culprits include an asteroid hitting Earth, or the eruption of a supervolcano, or the collapse of our food system caused by climate change, or the rise of a totalitarian regime that uses surveillance and AI to control all of humanity. Just in case you need some fuel for your nightmares. Happy Easter! I got those specific ideas from the Foresight Institute, an organization whose mission is advancing technology for the long-term benefit of life. They're trying to solve those problems before they come up. They work on high-impact ideas that are too early stage for anyone else to take the financial risk. Radical, cutting-edge technology that they think can save the world. And they focus their work in six areas: nanotech, biotech, neurotech, computation, space, and hope. Yes, alongside figuring out the feasibility of space settlement and discovering a source of unlimited clean energy, the scientists at Foresight are working on the cutting-edge technology of hope. Existential hope, which they say is the chance of something extremely good happening. They say that they see that chance as highly possible, by the way. But in order to get there, they say, or in order to be ready for it, if we get there, we first have to hope for it. Existential hope is essential for our survival. For the future of all life, to imagine and plan for the possibility of something good, of something extremely good, surprisingly good, unexpectedly beautiful. We have to expect it, to treat it as real, as solid, even more than the doom that feels so inevitable now, or maybe always. The technology that we need in this moment is eucatastrophe, to tell our story again as one which can, which will eventually have a happy ending. A couple years ago, the Foresight Institute held a contest for people to come up with a better word for it, eucatastrophe, which I've had to say several times in this sermon already. They thought it was a little clunky. Plus, it has catastrophe right there in the middle of it, which doesn't really bring hope to mind. They wanted to have a name for it because being able to name a thing is the first step to imagining it, to making it real. Some of the options were Benepetea, a combination of bene, meaning good, and peripeteia, meaning a sudden reversal, an idea that came from someone that definitely didn't understand what was wrong with the word in the first place. But there were also plethoration, the realization of abundance, and de la joy, a feeling of transcending joy, and gleditar, Icelandic apparently for tears of joy, or two of my personal favorites, fantastrophe, which I really love, and the very straightforward, big, happy surprise. The winner ultimately was efflorescence, a process of unfolding and blossoming. The technology that we most need in this moment is the belief that life could turn out to be a story of efflorescence. That your life, that our collective life can open into something beautiful like all of these flowers. That we are, all of us, hurtling toward one giant fantastrophe. Of course, we already have a word for it, a story of it. But no one has ever believed the story of resurrection. Even the women who discover the empty tomb, the angels remind them, you've heard this story already. Don't you remember? He told you what would happen, how he would be turned over and crucified and rise again. But you didn't believe. Here you are looking for the living among the dead, looking for what is real and solid among what is temporary and flimsy. And then they believe and they run off to tell the others who don't until Jesus shows up to them there in that room. And then they tell Thomas who missed it and he doesn't buy it until he can touch Jesus for himself. No one has ever believed the story of resurrection. It's not just us. It's not just now. It has been true in every hopeless moment from that very first one. No one has ever believed the story of resurrection. It always seems an idle tale, but anyone who has ever experienced it can't stop telling it anyway. Anyone who has stood at the tomb's entrance with tears in their eyes only to find it empty, anyone who has stood on the edge of their own abyss seeing no way out only to discover at the very last moment a path into a good future, anyone who has pushed back on the ugliness and hopelessness that seemed so solid only to feel it give way to something stronger and more real beneath it, anyone who has glimpsed that underlying truth of efflorescence wants to share it. There is no way to preach the resurrection, not convincingly. It is unconvincing. It is incredible, impossible. Foolishness, nonsense. Everything we know points in the opposite direction, so I'll stop trying. And instead, friends, I pray that you will experience it. In whatever private grief or fear you are holding these days, whatever tomb to which you have been traveling each morning, whatever brink of hopelessness you are standing on, may the God who made you and who loves you surprise you with a sudden, joyous turn when you least expect it. And in our collective pain at the state of the world, all the destruction and violence that feel so real, the wars that break our hearts, the systems that fail us, the dread we carry that makes hope such hard work. May the God of resurrection perform the miracle again. Show us the empty tomb. Let us touch the living body. Remind us that our story, the world's story, creation's story, is not one of universal final defeat. It is a story with a happy ending.